This is the 2006 Palm Springs Bible School. Brother Colin Badger's topic is The Ecclesia in the Wilderness, a thematic study of the Book of Numbers. The topic for the first class is Introduction and Background to the Book of Numbers.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. And welcome, friends. And do we have any young people? Yes. Delusions in the wilderness. Oh, dear. Like a tale that is told. Very good. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Sorry, like our fellow speaking brother, I don't have my good wife with me. We've just come back from being with the Bible Mission in Trinidad and Tobago. I have a mother that lives with us, and she's fairly infirmed. So we just can't push the envelope all the time. So my good wife is here in the sense that she is supporting me tremendously. Brothers and sisters, we have chosen a study for ourselves this week that actually is a new study for myself. I have personally been toying with doing a study of the Book of Numbers for a Bible school series for some years, as a matter of fact. I have a fairly close friendship with Brother Stephen Palmer from Cardiff, and he sowed this seed a number of years ago when he was in Ontario, and we were talking together, and he said, "You know, Colin, Numbers is just full of ecclesial applications, let alone personal applications." And Stephen usually does so very good thoughts. So I'm indebted to him in that sense for finally having done something of a series here for the Book of Numbers. And I would never have guessed that the first time we would do it would be in the desert. So that is purely coincidental. Here we are looking at the whole of the Book of Numbers. And when we do a study of a whole book like Numbers, as large as it is, there's always the challenge of trying to take off more than you can chew for the week. I hope we haven't done that, because we are going to be selective. We're going to be thematic, but we're also going to try and get information as well as transformation, as Brother Anthony has rightly directed us. In fact, Brother Anthony has given us some rather helpful leads in terms of his, you might have noticed, references to the wilderness experience, to the Exodus, and we'll try to remember those as we go through this introductory class. It helps to tie things together. Well, the Book of Numbers appears to some, no doubt, to be about as dry as the setting of the Book of Numbers. When people hear numbers, they automatically cringe, some. It sounds protracted, dull, and disinteresting. But in fact, we hope by the end of the session this morning to highlight the fact that in the New Testament, there are incredible number of references to incidents, concepts, principles, both personally and ecclesially, and they come from the Book of Numbers. And if the New Testament, including the Lord Jesus Christ, of course, refers to the Book of Numbers that many times in the way that they do by inspiration, we ought to change our paradigm and our perspective towards a book that at first seems, because of some of its chronology and the names and so on, rather dry. It is rich in exhortation, brothers and sisters. Let's just take a look, by way of introduction in our first class here, at fundamentally the name of the book. The name Book of Numbers, you may be aware of this, in fact, is not a Hebrew tradition at all. In the Hebrew Bible, it was never called the Book of Numbers. It was entitled in the Hebrew by about the second or third word that appears in the Hebrew canon, In the Wilderness. Would you turn to Numbers chapter 1, please? Let's get the context of this. The Hebrews did not call it the Book of Numbers. That comes really from the Greek Septuagint and from later traditions that worked its way finally into the English Bible. As pertinent as it is to call this book the Book of Numbers, it's by no means a misnomer. There's definite relevance to calling it the Book of Numbers. But the Hebrew canon and the Hebrew tradition is quite interestingly, to call it the wilderness. As we come to Numbers chapter 1, here's where the Hebrews get this tradition. Verse 1, "And the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness." Hebrew, as we have it right now on the screen, the Hebrew is Bemidbar, or in the wilderness. So, forcefully, as much as Numbers help to tell some of the story of the book of Numbers, I think it's actually more appropriate to take and to apply the Hebrew tradition here, which I think captures more meaningfully what this is all about. This is a generation that was to come into the wilderness, a generation that was to perish in the wilderness, a generation, however, that was to be born in the wilderness, the second generation, and a generation, that second generation, that was to be addressed by the book of Deuteronomy. All the book of Deuteronomy is addressed to the second generation, because it's given, the book of Deuteronomy, and this is no guess, it's right there at the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy. It is delivered by Moses in the 40th year, within a matter of months of coming into the land. So the second generation in the wilderness is unique in having the book of Deuteronomy as a summary and an expansion of what had been delivered previously in the books of Moses, particularly in the law itself. As we come to the New Testament, our passage now is rather important. Would you turn it up with me, please? Screen slides can be useful, but they can also make us lazy. We ought not to use the screen visuals as a replacement for turning the pages. So let's just, if you would with me, turn to Acts chapter 7 here. Because in Stephen's inspired summary of the history of Israel, which has a point, more than one point, in fact, but a major point that he comes to climatically at the end of that speech. In Stephen's selective, inspired account of Israel's past history, we come in Stephen's speech to verse 37 for context of Acts 7. And we read, verse 37, "This is that Moses," says Stephen, "which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren like unto me, him shall ye hear. This is he that was in the ecclesia in the wilderness with the angel which spake to him in the Mount Sinai and with our fathers who received the lively oracles." Now, that's an important way of looking at the book of Numbers. That is largely referring to the book of Numbers. Exodus doesn't give us a lot of chronology about the events of the wilderness. Deuteronomy only gives us what was delivered in the 40th year and so many months, in fact, before they entered the land. It's the book of Numbers that we turn to get a chronology, a narrative of just exactly, selectively, according to God's wisdom, what we should know, about what happened in the wilderness. Leviticus focuses on the doctrines, the teachings, the commandments, the holy rules, the way of holiness. It deals with teaching as such. It's didactic, we would say today. So Leviticus doesn't deal with what happened in the wilderness. Exodus only a little bit. Deuteronomy, we're at the end of the journey in the 40th year. It's Numbers that tells us what happened to the ecclesia and specific individuals in the wilderness. And Stephen is inspired to say that in the wilderness there was an ecclesia. That's the Greek word there for a church. He, moreover, was in that ecclesia. Let's grab that point. He was in that ecclesia. And it, was in the wilderness. So he was in the wilderness. You know, brothers and sisters, that in fact is part of the whole narrative here in Acts chapter 7 of Stephen's speech. He's trying to break the exclusiveness of the Jewish paradigm. He's trying to help the Jews get out of the box who had crucified Christ, and now we're about to crucify or kill him and persecute the ecclesia. And they were running against themselves, and they were running against their own history. And Stephen is trying to get them to realize that God was not exclusively their God. They had missed the train, in a certain sense, as the rulers of the people. What he labors is that, at the beginning of Acts 7, God came to Abraham in Babylon. And God took him out of Babylon. And God was wherever his person was, Abraham, or wherever his extended family was. And finally, God was where his nation was. And therefore, as you read through Stephen's inspired speech, one thing you do find as part of the theme is the non-exclusiveness of God and a breakaway from them thinking that the God of Israel was their God by possession, and a challenging to them about the gospel going to the Gentiles, and an exhortation to them to realize that God was not tied just to them. God was a holy God. Wherever he was, there was holiness, be it in Babylon or be it out of Babylon, be it in the wilderness or be it in the, quotes, promised land. He was not constrained to one parcel of real estate. That's part of Stephen's point. And here, he makes this inspired comment by describing the nation as an ecclesia in the wilderness. And he was in that ecclesia in the wilderness, in the sense, graphically as we have a reminder here, in the sense that he dwelt in their midst. And day by day, when they moved, he showed his presence by the pillar of fire and by the cloud. He was in the most holy, in a very real sense. He was in the inspired judgment of the priests and the rulers and the judges of Israel. He was in Moses' mouth. He was in the rod. In all of those various applications, he was in the ecclesia and he was in the wilderness. So what? Reminding us of the very relevant point that Brother Anthony made a few moments ago. That's the fact, but what's the point? The point is, as Stephen is highlighting it, God actually placed in the past his ecclesia in the wilderness. And that's where we find ourselves today, in the wilderness of men. We live in the times of the Gentiles. We live at a time when he is still overturning until he comes, whose right it is. We're in that period of time, though we believe we're at the very end of it. God was in an ecclesia with all of its weakness, with all of its failings in the past. And it's an exhortation in positive form for us today that despite our weaknesses and despite the fact there's been a long time that's passed and despite the fact that we are at the end of Gentile times, God has not deserted this ecclesia, the broader community. He is in this ecclesia, in the wilderness. He was in the past, he is now, he always will be. And although we find ourselves in sometimes dispiriting and discouraging conditions and wonder why the wilderness, they wondered the same thing. But he assured them that in their trials, in the midst of the wilderness of sin, they had ample reason to believe he was there, working with them. Despite the failings of some of the rulers, despite even the slip of Moses, despite the failings of Miriam, the failings of Aaron, the failings of some of the princes and the rulers like Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, he was in the wilderness. He was in the ecclesia. He was there to be trusted and believed in. And he was a holy God in their midst. It's a sobering exhortation to see that. Something else, though, we might just miss here in Stephen's inspired comment. They received in the wilderness, now notice the contrast, lively oracles. The word means living. And here, too, it's an aside. It's not part of Stephen's main point. But it is important to notice every word counts here in the inspired text. Have you thought of this, that the living oracles are being stressed in verse 38 as they are juxtaposed, they are in contrast to, cheek to jowl, against the wilderness, which was a place of death. That whole generation perished with the exception of the faithful, the two faithful. The wilderness is equivalent really to death. But in death, in a death place, where bodies were strewn for almost 38 years through that desert, all that time, because God was in the ecclesia, in the wilderness, they had, in contrast to the death around them, living oracles. Today, our young people are told in school it's just print on page. Even those who pretend to be faithful commentators will sometimes not accept the inspiration of the Bible and talk about it again as simply print on paper. In the wilderness, we need to make sure we truly believe, and we encourage our friends and our young people to trust and to understand why there is reason to see the Bible in front of us as we hold it in the wilderness as being living oracles. If he's in the ecclesia, in the wilderness, there will be living oracles because the living God is in their presence. Would you turn to Jeremiah 2? This is not a passage we would normally turn to, perhaps, or think about as we're looking at the book of Numbers, but this is very pertinent. As the curtains rise in Jeremiah's prophecy, and as Jeremiah in his prelude, his inspired prelude in these early chapters of Jeremiah, sets the stage for the whole of this weighty prophecy, there's a rehearsal of history, like there is, as a matter of fact, in both Deuteronomy and partly in Numbers. Here in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 1, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem." Now he's going to rehearse their history. Past tense, verse 3, "Israel was holiness unto the Lord, and the first fruits of his increase." Then verse 5, "Thus saith the Lord, What iniquity have your fathers found in me?" It's like Stephen's kind of speech. "That they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and are become vain. Neither said they..." Now watch this introduction to history, this review of Numbers. "Neither said they, Where is Yahweh, that brought us up out of the land of Egypt?" In Jeremiah's day, and he overshadows Josiah, likely Josiah has now just passed away, not too much before these opening words of Jeremiah, because he was a contemporary for a while. Here in this time when Babylon is about to be used as an instrument of God to take them into Babylon and chastise them, Jeremiah is crying to them that they have not asked the question, "Where is the Lord?" That's the question that was asked by the murmurers in the wilderness again and again. Where is God in my life? Where is he in this wilderness? Is he in the ecclesia? We don't know it. Where is the food that we want? Where are the blessings that we supposedly had in Egypt? Where is the Lord? They are not asking. "That brought us up out of the land of Egypt, that," watch this, "that led us through the wilderness." Now watch these adjectives. "Through a land of deserts," plural, one desert after another, "and of pits." Have you ever thought of the wilderness that way? As you picture the wilderness, it wasn't just a sandy desert. It was a place of pits. How descriptive, spiritually speaking, of what a wilderness is always to do with when we think of the wildernesses that we travel through, especially the larger wilderness of the world. When we think we are going through and understand we are passing in a desert-like spell in our lives, we often say, I'm in the pits. And the desert wasn't just a flat plate of sand that went on forever. There were pits. And you know, at times, that pillar rose up at night. That pillar sometimes forced them to break camp at night. And if they had to break it in that way, and the pillar moved at night, tents had to be collapsed, people had to rally, and they had to move. Or if it was in the wee hours of the morning, just as the sun was rising, it would have been still fairly dark or dusky. And if they had been traveling all day, and now the cloud or the pillar rested, and it was getting dark and they were about to set camp, there were times when it wasn't just flat desert. There were pits. It was a dangerous place. They needed his guidance. And you can see, trying to set up tent, and unless that pillar of fire or that shining cloud was illuminating the place, you would have had some real challenges. It was dangerous in that sense. It was a place of dry, arid sand, but it was also a place of pits. Through a land of drought and of the shadow of death. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You know Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Do you know Psalm 23 is drawing on this? This is the first time this phrase appears, and likely it's the source of Psalm 23's reference, though no doubt it was a fairly well-known kind of phrase or saying. Its historical roots for Psalm 23 is right here, and undoubtedly refers to a shadow of death. And there's those kind of connections elsewhere before Jeremiah, but put in so many words as a specific reference, it seems that likely this would be the main source for what is, in fact, the idea for David. It's not to say that David is quoting Jeremiah, because Jeremiah comes later, of course. But whatever Jeremiah is saying in chapter 2 about a description of the wilderness must have been something, in fact, that was well known as a shorthand phrase to describe the wilderness experience. So indeed, Jeremiah comes after David. But that phrase here in Jeremiah is, in fact, the phrase that is found there in Psalm 23, and they're both obviously referring to some source of description of the wilderness that goes way, way back, a shorthand description of that experience. So Jeremiah is referring to the same kind of thing as the valley of the shadow of death, and it's no doubt the wilderness of sin. So through a land of deserts, of pits, through a land of drought, the shadow of death, through a land that no man passed through and where no man dwelt, clearly, the wilderness that the ecclesia was in, according to Acts chapter 7, was a wilderness connected to death. And yet, verse 7, Jeremiah says, I brought you into a plentiful country to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof. Now also, before they came into that plentiful country, they had, in contrast to the death, the pits, the desert, the drought, they had, in contrast, the living oracles. So when he stresses the living oracles in Acts chapter 7, in the context of the wilderness experience, and describing the land as a land of the shadow of death, David, Jeremiah, and other biblical writers clearly are drawing on a source that goes way back before the time of David himself. It's clearly a situation where the living oracles were needed to stand against the wall of death. The living oracles were the means by which God could bring his people through a dying, horrid, pitted wilderness. The map that we have next here just reminds us of something, again, that Brother Anthony referred to, that In fact, the distance could have been fairly short. From the time they were at Mount Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea was only about an 11-day journey at the most. Of course, it could have been shorter if perhaps one man was walking it. And the distance from that up to here was obviously, by the scale of that map, probably not even as much as that. And yet, time passed. Short as the journey was, only about 11 days from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, and not so many days up to the period to the place of the Jordan, the people ended up spending 38 years after Sinai, 40 altogether. God's purpose, though, was still fulfilled. God still, through the living oracles, was able to preserve this people. He was able to save them in the second generation for his plan and purpose. But had it not been for the living oracles, let alone the water, and let alone the manna that he provided for them temporally, if they had not had the living oracles, they would all have perished. The second generation that was born in the wilderness and was raised in the wilderness had obviously to hold on to those living oracles. And so at the end of the 40 years, to the new generation, the oracles are reviewed in Deuteronomy, expanded, not just repeated. And directions are given for the coming into the land. Those oracles, however, had been sustained previously by the inspired counsel of Aaron, Moses, Joshua, the elders, the judges of Israel. They provided the livingness to those oracles that they needed. So, brothers and sisters, as we look at the book of Numbers thematically, and we think of our own life as a place of wilderness, drought, the shadow of death, and the pits that can trip us up in the darkness, let alone in the day, what we really need to understand from the book of Numbers is that God was there even in the wilderness of sin. He was in the ecclesia. He was there to behold, to be prayed to, and to find strength from, even in the wilderness. And although all around them was death, there were living oracles right there in front of them to feed, to guide, to refresh, to direct, and to save them from the plight of those who were to perish day by day in the wilderness. Why the wilderness? Well, let's explore that today in some of the remaining moments that we have, but also through the course of the week. It's not our only question. It's not our only theme. But why the wilderness? All right, we've talked about the fact that God is in the wilderness, that God provided living oracles, that the ecclesia is the nation. The nation is the ecclesia, from Stephen's words. We've stressed the challenging conditions and the adjectives and the way the desert can be described, that both Jeremiah and David are drawing on the same kind of source. And what David says is, in fact, from the same source as what Jeremiah does have at his disposal. A description of a wilderness experience that was equated for many as being one of death, but life for a few. Why, though, does God put them through that? Why does he put us through that? Why not a shorter passage? Why not have taken them into the land earlier and then have tested them? Why the wilderness? Brother Harry Tennant, in the book that he wrote so many years ago, The Man David, which we've just got footnoted down here at the bottom, wrote the following in The Man David. And perhaps you've noticed, he talks about the wilderness. The way of the wilderness, says Harry, is a bitter journey. Every man who truly follows the Lord comes to that part of his journey sooner or later. Perhaps his sin brings him there. Perhaps the trials of his faith, or the chastisement of the love of God. Now remember, why the wilderness? The experience, says Brother Harry, is necessary to our proper growth. By it, self-reliance and vanity are destroyed, and the dross is purged from our faith. Typical vintage Harry, yes? Eloquent, simple, powerful, memorable. It says it well. The experience is necessary to our proper growth. By it, the wilderness experience, self-reliance and vanity are destroyed, and the dross is purged from our faith. Now, Harry goes on and says this in the same context of the man David. He says, the wilderness is made for hope, not for despair. The extremity of man's experience brings him to the rock in a weary land, to the table furnished by the hand of God, to the well of water in a parched place. Then Harry says, beautifully, many a man has found God in the wilderness when he had lost him in the city. Now that is worth pondering. Because the context here of the man David in Harry's writings is referring to the Judean wilderness and David's experience fleeing from Saul. And then later on, David's return to the wilderness near Mahanaim when he was fleeing from Absalom. So he had at least two kinds of wilderness experiences. Harry is commenting on this wilderness experience by David, who was the one who wrote, as we just said previously, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." David was to return to the wilderness more than once. But in the early part of his life, when he was being challenged by Saul, constantly he must have asked the question, why the wilderness for me if I'm being called to be king? God was no doubt doing exactly what Harry is suggesting here. The extremity of man's experience brings him to the rock in a weary land, to the table furnished by the hand of God, to the well of water in a parched place. And brothers and sisters, many of us, as Harry rightly says, and including David later on in his life after he'd committed his great sin and then returned once again to the wilderness, many a man or woman, many a brother or sister has found God in the wilderness when he lost him or when she lost him in the city. You know, brothers and sisters, there's a fundamental answer, I believe, to the question, why the wilderness? We can see it from the scriptures we've already raised. Part of it, the answer, is clearly in Jeremiah. Jeremiah was saying, where is the Lord? A question you're not asking and you're not finding an answer to. In the days of Jeremiah, the Lord could be found anywhere. In the end, God was going to, after Jeremiah, take them to Babylon. And they would travel through a desert once again, partly, as they went down into the Euphrates, the Ark of the Fertile Crescent, and they would be dragged there as slaves, and some of them would perish on the way. It would be partially a reenactment of the Exodus experience, and then you'd have to bring them back again through 70 years later. Again, there would be a kind of Exodus experience. So part of the answer is there even in Jeremiah. Part of it is obviously there in Acts chapter 7. It's to show them that even in the wilderness, faith can be developed. Perhaps we could say, especially in the wilderness, faith can be developed. Part of Brother Harry's point, not having found him, perhaps properly in the city, the wilderness experience can sometimes bring us to our knees, can bring us to the table in the wilderness, can bring us by hand to the well that's there in the wilderness. And whereas we might not have found God in days of prosperity, in the humdrum of our daily comfortable lives, in times of prosperity, just perhaps we find him in less comfortable conditions. Perhaps trials and tribulations, the pits of our lives, the wilderness experience may just in fact bring us closer to the well and tuck us a little tighter to the table that God can furnish even in a wilderness, and there find closer fellowship with our Heavenly Father. There are a number of psalms which comment on the wilderness experience, either from David's own or reflections historically on the period of the Exodus. Would you turn to Psalm 63, please? It's good to look up the passage yourself and see it in front of you. Psalm 63, in this case, there's a particular reason for turning the Bible page, because you ought to notice that the caption at the beginning of Psalm 63, which we do have on the slide, reads as follows, and here's why we've chosen this psalm in part. A psalm of David, we notice, a psalm of David, when he was in the wilderness of Judah. O God, thou art my God, early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. He yearns, David does, both literally and spiritually, to be refreshed by his God. There was a time when he actually yearned to actually physically drink the water from the well of Bethlehem. And his two companions furnished him that quickly. But it's not really what he meant. And he poured it on the ground. It's not really what he was about. He really yearned to have closer fellowship with God through the help of what was there in Jerusalem, through the assistance of the temple, the work of the priests. He yearned for that kind of presence, that kind of closeness, and a desire, obviously, for some rest. But most importantly, in the wilderness, he was encouraged to thirst. You see the point? Why the wilderness? We are encouraged to thirst. Not just for water, brothers and sisters, but in our trials and in our difficulties, is it not true we are encouraged to thirst? Where in days of prosperity and comfort, we may not thirst, we may not yearn, we may not long, but when we're in the squeeze, when we're in a pit, when we're frustrated, and there's no way out, it seems, like Joseph in a pit, like Jeremiah in a pit, it's in those conditions that human nature is most likely to thirst and to long and yearn for God. Verse 2 of Psalm 63, remember, it's a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness. He yearns, quotes in verse 2, to see thy power and thy glory, which of course was focalized in the temple in Jerusalem, to see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. So that's obviously part of David's thought. David knew he could reach God in the wilderness. David knew, unlike those who murmured in the wilderness, he knew he could find his God anywhere. He knew as a young boy he had found him against the bear and the lion. He knew he had found him against Goliath. He knew he didn't have to be in a geographical location. But he yearns, in the wilderness especially, he pines for his God. You know, brothers and sisters, as we travel through the wilderness this week in the book of Numbers and look at some of its themes and some of the events, the successes and the failings of those who traveled that way in that journey, positively, we ought not to forget that the wilderness is designed to make us thirst. It's designed to make us long for something better. And human nature, being what it is, needs that encouragement. So as they finally did, in fact, come to the Mount of Sinai, yet to go on for quite a number of years yet, they're assembled at that mount a huge number of people that were ordered. The book of Numbers begins with order. It begins with the numbering of the people and an organizational approach is taken. Look at Numbers chapter 1. It's very obvious. It may be a part that looks rather dull to us, but the passage we had read partly for us by way of introduction in Numbers chapter 1 is an ordering. It is a preparation for a proper camp. It's a numbering as well for those who will serve in war. In verse 3, that's very obvious. From 20 years old and upwards, all that were able to go to war in Israel, thou and Aaron shalt number them by their armies. When you travel on to the order of their tents and their tribes, you come to chapter 2, orderliness. Verse 2 of Numbers 2. Every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard with the ensign of their father's house. Far off about the tabernacle of the congregation shall they pitch. And then begins directional indications. And on the east side toward the rising of the sun shall they of the standard of the camp of Judah pitch. Numbers 2 verse 3. There they are, getting specific directions. Later, when they march, there are specific directions in the book of Numbers. So Numbers begins by giving us a bird's eye view, although this picture may not be accurate by any means. It gives you some idea of what it must have been like to stand on some of the mounts from a distance and see this innumerable people as the sand of the sea, organizing themselves, as Numbers gives the directions, into their various camps in the area. The tabernacle obviously being in their midst. A tremendous scene, really. Paul says in Corinthians, let all things be done decently and in order. That's very much in the spirit here of the camp of God, because God is going to bring order to a disorderly people. Here's the people that were slaves, and now they're a nation to be. Here were people that were randomly slaves in mud pits and brick kilns and so on, in fields laboring for Pharaoh. Now they were to become the nation of God, an ecclesia in the wilderness. There is a symmetry, there is an order in the book of Numbers that may not be at first apparent, being as large as it is, the book of Numbers. There were two generations. There were two numberings. There were two journeyings. And there were two instructings. The second instructing being, in the end, for the new generation. So if you haven't noticed before, there's a two-ness in that sense. In the book of Numbers, there's like a couplet situation. Two generations, one perished, one went into the land. Two numberings, those who died, but those who became the living generation that went in under Joshua's direction. There was the journey to Sinai. There was the journey through the wilderness that finally led for the second generation into the promised land. There were the instructions given at Sinai and the second set of instructions that we have in the book of Deuteronomy that review and expand and to some extent for sure repeat. But here, in the book of Numbers, we ought to notice this two-ness. Because the secondness, if we can call it that, ungrammatically, the secondness of this is the contrast of life versus death. Why are there two? Because one relates to the first generation, and the second relates to the living generation that will go in under Joshua and inherit the land. So the two-ness, the second partness, if we can put it so ungrammatically, is in fact stressing the fact that, well, there was death and there was life. There were those that perished and there were those who lived. Those who never went in and never saw, those who did go in and experience and establish their inheritance. It's like that passage in Matthew, two shall be grinding at the mill. Two shall be in the field. One taken, one left. That's very much what's being said here. So although numbers feel rather dry to some of us, and although there may not seem to be much sense in the way numbers labors this, there's a story in the numbers, and there's a symmetry about the way numbers is constructed. In that sense, there is a message. It's not just data. It's a message that comes from the information. We wish to be those who are not left. We wish to be those who go in. Now, dates, too, of course, not the type we had at the back, but dates, too, can be important. And again, Brother Anthony mentioned some of this morning, just in passing, as he was talking about transformation. The Exodus from Egypt, 15th day of the first month. They arrive at Sinai on the first day of the third month of the first year. The completion of the tabernacle, however, was on the first day of the first month of the second year. And then finally, pertinent to our studies this week down here, the command to number Israel was on the first day, notice, of the second month of the second year. Notice here, the exodus from Sinai on the 15th day of the first month to their arrival was only 3 months. Notice down here, we're into the second year when the tabernacle is completed. And notice that the command to number Israel at the beginning of the book of Numbers and the start of the march was in the second month of the second year. Yes, time has passed, but that time was intended to help them gel and solidify. That time also was involved in helping them to learn what had been delivered at Sinai. God was not in a hurry. And there was opportunity here for lessons to be grasped, for order to be given, for the priests to get exercised. There was opportunity to get things in place, get their ducks in order, we might say. But the journey was never intended to be as long as it was. Now just notice here what the Apostle Paul says. Would you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10? I'm going to look at verses 1 to 5 as we come to an end of our second class this morning. We said that the New Testament would show significant connections to the book of Numbers. In just the last few minutes, I want to highlight how much the New Testament leans on the book of Numbers in that sense. Moreover, says Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1, moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink. Then he says, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Here's Paul talking about the wilderness. Some of those incidents connect with Exodus. Some of them connect with Numbers. In particular, he is stressing that all went in. But in the end, many of them were not well-pleasing to God, and many were overthrown in the wilderness. A sober lesson, partly taken from the book of Numbers and its events, brought forth into the New Testament. Paul says, neither let us commit fornication. 1 Corinthians 10 here. Now this time, he's referring to the book of Numbers. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell. In one day, 3,000, he's referring to Numbers 25. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. He's referring to Numbers with the serpent issue, as we referred to the exhortation yesterday. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured. That's recorded in Exodus, but also in Numbers especially. And were destroyed of the destroyer. So now just watch. Here in this New Testament passage, the exhortation to the Corinthians is resting from exhortations drawn largely from the book of Numbers. Numbers 25, Numbers 21, and especially also Numbers 14, verse 2. Although Exodus has some references to murmuring as well. It's just to show how much the incidents, the narrative, the theme of the book of Numbers is brought forward into the New Testament, as it is in Acts. Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, says Jude, and ran greedily after the heir of Balaam for reward, says Jude, and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Jude 1, verse 11. And where is that from? The book of Numbers. These are spots, says Jude, in your feast of charity when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds are they without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. Numbers 22 to Numbers 24, Numbers 16. Significant. Jude, Peter, Corinthians, all referring to the book of Numbers. And finally, brothers and sisters, as we end with reference to Numbers from the book of Numbers, you know, Numbers themselves in the book of Numbers or in the book of the wilderness, in fact, tell a story. Here's a simple bar graph, and here are the tribes across the bottom here. And barred up on the top, you can see the numbers that are given in Numbers chapter 1 and 2. The numbers when they were numbered in Numbers chapter 1, right there. And notice Simeon, where I've now circled it. And notice Judah, if you will, where I've just circled it. Beginning of the wilderness, the old generation. Notice Numbers in Simeon and Numbers in Judah. Numbers chapter 1. What about Numbers 26? Numbers in Simeon, Numbers in Judah. What's happened to Simeon at the end? There's something that's happened, and Numbers tells the story. Is it just natural death, or is there some connection with Simeon and the wilderness? Compare it again. Simeon decreases by 37,100, but Judah increased. There's a story in the numbers themselves. It's not just data. There's a spiritual lesson. Simeon, Judah, something has happened. So then, brothers and sisters, we'll conclude by the words of the apostle again, quoting from the book of Numbers. Paul says, neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day, 23,000. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 8, quoting from Numbers 25, verses 9 and 14. All through the wilderness, brothers and sisters, as we'll pick this up tomorrow, there were important events, but to start with was the first census and the last census. And between those two events was an important story in the numbers themselves.